Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
The official Brighton and Hove Albion podcast.
Welcome to the official Brighton and Hove Albion podcast with me, Glenn Murray. Without my regular partner in crime, I've been left the keys to the podcast as Paul's not with us this week, but he'll be back soon. So, this is the podcast that takes you behind the scenes at the club with exclusive conversations from current players, coaching staff, to legends of the past, and much more in between. And our guest today is one I've been really looking forward to catching up with, Brighton Women's interim head coach, Mikey Harris. Reassigned from the men's academy and placed in charge of the senior women's team, Harris has a unique CV as a coach, which includes time with Portsmouth, Southampton, Brighton and England under-18s, plus an early jaunt into the Salisbury City men's system, which is effectively where the magic happened. His time at the helm of the women's team could be short, or it may be long. Either way, he's undoubtedly got a challenge ahead of him as he attempts to navigate his squad up the WSL and secure the club's target of a top four finish. In this conversation, Mikey tells us about multiple transitions throughout the game, his time around the England setup, the influence of Gareth Southgate, and his footballing philosophy that talent needs trauma. Mikey, thank you for finding the time to come on the podcast.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I've been looking into you, Mikey, and I can't really find too much about you. So what I want to do is I want to paint a picture for people. I want to take them back. I want to learn about your playing, your coaching career, and then obviously we'll get on to you being interim's women's first team coach at the moment. So take me back, a young Mikey Harris.
Yeah, always loved football right from a young age. My dad was a huge influence on me. He was involved with the sort of youth team and the centre of excellence at Portsmouth at the time. So I was really fortunate as a young lad to grow up around the likes of Alan Ball, Peter Osgood, people like that. And then, you know, sort of when my dad was working with the youth teams at Portsmouth, all the players that came through then, the likes of Darren Anderton, Kit Simons, Andy Orford, Mark Kelly, you know, it was an amazing sort of group of young players that came through the club at that time. And, you know, I was just a little lad bouncing around the changing room and sort of involved with that sort of stuff. So was sort of exposed to that sort of level of football at a really, really early age. And it was just part of my life from then on, really.
So the dream was to grow up and play?
Yeah, of course. You know, when I was little, it was all I wanted to do. You know, I was in the centre of excellence at Portsmouth, went in there under nine, went through to under 16s, and then wasn't given a scholarship, which was pretty devastating at the time. Due to my size,
that wouldn't be an issue now.
No, I think it's a lot more sort of understanding and knowledge around that. But you know, it wasn't to be. So went to college, ended up playing with sort of my mates and really, really enjoying my football again, and then got picked up by Bournemouth and ended up there in their under 18s. But again, didn't get offered a professional contract. So went into the non-league game at Salisbury. And then for the next 10 years,
We'll get on to Salisbury, because it's quite a long story, Salisbury.
Yeah, it is.
But
yeah.
just touching on your point there about being released, I was very similar to you. But I suppose that puts you in really good stead for the jobs that you've had since. You've obviously been down to Southampton in the under 18s. You've been involved in our academy here. So I suppose being in that system and understanding what it's like to be released gives you a little bit more feeling about young lads sort of leading into those answers and those, I suppose, life-changing decisions.
100%. And, you know, I can genuinely, when I look across the table and have to release a player from their contract, which I've had to do, you know, many times over the years, it never gets any easier. But I have got that experience and that empathy of how it feels, which hopefully gives you the opportunity to deal with that situation in the best possible way for the player. Also, what I've learned over the years is that sometimes releasing a player can be the best thing for them. It can be the best thing for their career. And although it might not feel like it at that time, some of the players that I've worked with, I wonder if they didn't get released, whether they would have gone on to have the careers that they did have. Because I think, you know, there's that phrase that talent needs trauma. And I think sometimes, you know, sometimes that's a good example of that. You know, the most talented players need that little setback or that bump in a road to develop their resilience, which, you know, as you know more than anyone, you need to be a top professional.
Talent needs trauma. That's the first time I've heard that.
Is it?
But I needed it.
Yeah.
I did need it. I
can relate to that, Glenn.
I fell into that bracket. Yeah, 100%. And it's a really difficult time in a young man or a young girl's life. I think it probably falls into walking around school and people putting you on a pedestal that you're part of a professional organisation. And then losing that, it feels like you've almost lost your identity. Yeah. Do you think that football in general should look after those kids a little bit more, give them a bit more support?
Well, I think generally the game does now. I think the level of resource that's put into player care, to psychology, to all the sort of multidisciplinary areas of the game, I think now is vastly different to what it was only years ago.
I mean, after when you haven't got all those people to talk to and you're not part of the club anymore.
Yeah, well, I think every club now has a duty of care to do that for 3 years. It's certainly something that we take very, very seriously here. So I think it can definitely get better, and I think it is getting better. But I think, particularly here, I think it's in a good place, and the intention is to improve it and to support those players that leave us moving forward.
Yes, agreed. I think it's a very difficult time in a young person's life when you get a rejection of that magnitude, especially when all you can see, like you know, is sort of that next step and being a professional footballer. Let's take it to Salisbury, because that is a long, very interesting story, isn't it?
I'm not sure how interested it is,
I think it is, because you are the first generation of professional coaches. I think that there was a time where a lot of players would have a career and then they would begin coaching at 30, 35, and that was the natural transition. And I think that is probably the majority of the jobs fell like that, whereas you are part of the new breed of learning how to coach from an early age, which I think it's a very European trait, isn't it? And I think can only advance our game. Kieran McKenna, somebody who's doing really well at Ipswich, very, very similar path. So you went to Salisbury as a player, and then I'll let you take it away.
Yeah, well, it's a long time ago now. But I arrived at Salisbury as an 18-year-old to go and play. I'd actually started my own coaching business, just doing after-school clubs and holiday schools and things like that. So I was already on the grass. And I think one of the biggest things that I'm grateful for in my journey is I've had a huge amount of time on the grass. Now, whether that's dealing with elite players, non-elite players, after-school clubs, grassroots stuff, that time on the grass and dealing with different groups, dealing with individuals in that context, I think has stood me in really good stead. But of course, my ambition at that point was to play at the highest level that I could. I had some amazing experiences. We went from the Southern League, to the National League or the Conference Premier as it was then. You know, played with some fantastic players who I'm still good mates with now. Obviously, Matt Tubbs probably being the most prominent one who scored a lot of goals when he went to Crawley, yes. Obviously, and took them through the...
I think everyone's heard of him.
Yeah, through the league. So, Tubbsy's a great mate of mine and, you know, countless other individuals who, you know, were top players at that level. And because I was doing my coaching business at the time and everyone knew that that was kind of what I was interested in as, alongside the playing, I sort of got asked to do a few sessions
at the club,
yeah, with the first team. So it started off as maybe warm-ups and passing drills. We didn't have a sports scientist or an S&C coach at that level or in those days. So, you know, I took an interest in that. I ended up actually doing a degree in sports science as well at the time. So I was kind of like balancing the three things: playing, going to university to get a sports science degree, not to be a sports scientist or a fitness coach, but to underpin my coaching knowledge, basically, because I wanted to know all that I could about the body and how it reacted to training, all that sort of stuff. So went and did that. And then, like I say, started doing more and more sessions with the team. And then it was a bit later on, so at the age of 23, where Tommy Widrington, the manager at the time...
It's not very late.
Yeah. I mean, five years from when I joined, I suppose, at the time, that was a huge chunk of my life.
So when did that passion of playing start outbalancing and changing towards that passion of coaching?
Yeah, well, it's really interesting because I remember Tommy saying to me, look, I want you to be my number two. I want you to be my assistant manager. And I was thinking, God, like, I'm still 23 and, you know, I'm still sort of, could still play. And but he said,
because that conversation could go two ways, couldn't it?
100%. And but he said to me, look, but if you're going to do it, you've got to do it. And, you know, you're going to have to stop playing and sort of move into this side because I need you sort of all in. And, you know, I was self-aware enough to know that my ability level wasn't probably going to take me to where I wanted it to in the game. You know, I set out to play in the football league like any other young player.
So just to be a professional and to make a living out of the game?
Yeah, of course. That was always kind of the ambition to start with. But then as you get a little bit older...
Is that self-awareness or is it maybe a little bit of not being confident enough?
It's a good question. I mean, I was generally pretty confident in my ability as a player. You know, physically, I struggled a bit, mainly because I wasn't the quickest. I wasn't the strongest. I wasn't the tallest.
I can feel you.
Yeah, I was technically pretty sound, but I didn't really have. I think every player that I've worked with that's made it has had an outstanding attribute. I'm not sure I had an outstanding attribute. I was just, you know, I was just all right, like being brutally honest.
That's a really big decision as a 23-year-old.
Yeah.
The right one, obviously, as we sit here now.
Yeah, I think so. And I certainly don't regret it. Although, yeah, I mean, I still love playing. You know, we play star football here. We played this morning. You know, I had a couple of years playing vets football and, you know, enjoying that. So, look, I love the game. Play if there's a five-a-side game going, you know, I'm there. But, you know, I could sense an opportunity, you know, to be the assistant manager of a club in the conference prem as a 23-year-old was, you know, that was too good an opportunity to turn down.
And for somebody like Tommy to see the potential in a yeah. young man like yourself.
Yeah, of course. I mean, Tommy was a huge name in the game, you know, Premier League footballer, fantastic coach, fantastic manager, someone who, you know, I thought I could learn a huge amount from, and I did learn a huge amount from, and, you know, I'll always be grateful to him for giving me that opportunity because, you know, there was a few raised eyebrows, as you can imagine, at the time. Yeah, that was a great experience. And, you know, we had a successful season, which then sort of got scrapped because we ended up effectively going into administration, the club. And then we ended up back in the Southern League. So having got promoted all the way to the top tier of the non-league, we then found ourselves back in the Southern League. But the incoming chairman decided to Tommy left to go to Southend in the Football League, completely understandably. And then the chairman, William Harrison Allen at the time, put myself and Daryl Clark in charge in the summer and said, look, we're going to stay full time because we're a full time club in the conference, but we're staying full time in the Southern League, but you got to get promoted.
Yeah.
You got, you, if you don't,
I think that's a fair request.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. but as you know, it's not as easy as that. It doesn't guarantee you.
Immediately everyone wants to beat you because you're the only professional team.
Exactly.
In it.
Exactly. And you know, it was a roller coaster of a season. We did manage to, we were actually 2-1 down in the playoff final in the 119th minute of extra time. A midfielder for us at the time, Ben Addlesbury, just closed his eyes and smashed one from 20 yards and it went in the bottom corner. We actually ended up winning on penalties. You know, the next season we consolidated in the Conference South, got to the third round of the FA Cup, played Sheffield United at Bramall Lane. And I remember Harry Maguire was playing that day. You could see, you know, as a young player, that he was going to have an incredible future. I was actually that was an interesting one because I was actually I was named among the substitutes for that game, and Daryl was playing, so I was in the dugout.
Oh, so you were
on my
effectively
own.
The manager.
Yeah, and I was for a lot of the time during Daryl's stint as manager because he was the manager, but he was still our best player.
Yeah.
So you know he played. So
that must have been a really nice period for you to learn how to
absolutely.
Be on the sidelines and. Then eventually that led to you actually becoming the manager at the ripe age of 28.
28, yeah. And you'll like this story. I'll tell you this. I'll share this one with you because when I was assistant manager and Daryl was still playing, we actually played against Wrexham in the FA Trophy and Dean Saunders was manager. And I remember him going to shake his hand before the game and him saying to me, like, what are you doing? Like, how young are you? Why are you not still playing? Like, what are you doing? And I was like, oh, no, you know, like I really enjoyed the coaching and I'm happy to be in this. And he's like, I'm not sure about that. You should have stayed playing, lad, you know, as long as you can. And he said, anyway, enjoy your day. And I was like, well, enjoy your day. Okay, all right, interesting. Yeah. And then we ended up beating them 1-0. So obviously...
Did you shake his hand at the end and say, I enjoyed my day?
I really enjoyed my day, Dean. Yeah, thanks. you got a lot of that, particularly from... senior experienced guys like him, you know, that would look down and kind of go like, not sure you look like you should still be playing. And
well, like I say, you were the first of a generation that is changing the game as it looks in England.
I suppose I've never really thought about it like that, but yeah, I was just lucky to be exposed to that sort of stuff at an early age. And you know, we managed to actually get promoted the following season back to the National League, and Daryl left for Bristol Rovers, and then I remember having a meeting with the chairman and he's sort of saying like, oh no, what are we going to do now, you know, we lost Tommy, lost Daryl, you know. And I'm like, well, you know, I could have a go, you know, I've basically been doing it for the last 3 years kind of to a point with Daryl playing, and he's sort of, you know, you're very young, you know, we probably need someone with a bit more experience. But, you know, I kind of backed myself a little bit and said, look, I think if you don't give it to me, like, I'll probably be time for me to move on. I've been here 9 years.
Played your cards, you know, very well.
Yeah, well, could have gone either way, right? So, and he said, look, I'll give you pre-season. And, you know, I think he spent probably every other day pre-season. He rang me up and told me someone else who'd applied. And it was, as you can imagine, you know, it was a good job, full-time professional club in the National League. So plenty of high-profile applicants. And I remember sort of towards the end of the pre-season sort of going, yeah, all right, well, you know, ring me up every blimmin' day and tell me someone who's applied, like, what do they know about the conference? What do they know about this team? You know, like, I'm the best person for this job. And I think, you know, for whatever reason, probably the cheap option, he gave me the job, and there was a kind of mixed reaction, I guess. I think some people thought he's too young, hasn't got enough experience.
How did you handle that?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't really pay any attention to it, to be honest. I was always confident in my ability to do the job. I think the staff and the players had worked with me for a number of years, the majority of them, and they knew that the role that I'd done during that time. So I think my biggest thing was, you know, did the players buy into what I was trying to do? And I felt like they did. As we spoke about earlier, you know, the setbacks and the bumps in the road. I lost my first three league games on the spin. And this is the fickle nature of football. I remember everyone sort of going, see, he's too young.
Jumping to conclusions.
Yeah, he doesn't know what he's doing. He's not ready. All those sorts of things. Great number two, but, you know, can't manage. So,
ruling out all the cliches.
Yeah, exactly. But I felt we were so close.
Performance-wise.
Yeah, performance-wise and just... we were really close, and I was actually happy with the direction that we were moving in. And again, like the fickle nature of football is, we then went on to win 7 out of the next 8 games, and we ended up after the sort of first quarter of the season in a playoff place. And I remember being asked after the game, "Do you realise that you're now the favourite for the Portsmouth job?" So I just remember laughing and saying, "So, you know, 6-7 weeks ago, I didn't have a clue what I was doing, and now I'm being linked with one of the biggest clubs in the you know, outside."
That's the industry we're in.
Exactly. And I at the time, and, you know, I've always been the same ever since. You know, I remember at that time as a manager, John Still, who was Luton manager, you know, absolute legend of the game. He was an amazing mentor to me that season. He really kind of took me under his wing. And I just remember him saying, "Never get too high, never get too low." And it's always stuck in my head. And, you know, when all the negative kind of feedback was flying around, I didn't let it affect me too much. And just the same as when everyone started saying nice things, you know, you don't let that go to your head either. You just stick to your principles, stick to your values, keep doing the best you can do. And then you see where it takes you.
Because as a manager, well, as a player looking at a manager, I should say, I always feel as though you are a real guiding light. And if you let negative press get to you, then that negative press will get to your team. So I've had managers, I've had a couple where whether you win 7 on the spin or whether you lose 7 on the spin, he will come in, his appearance would be the same, his demeanour would be the same. And that was settling for me as a player, especially when you're on a run of 7. But I've also had managers where you're on a bad run and I can see him unravelling, and that makes the group nervous.
Yeah, and I think you have to be mindful of the fact that, you know, players, staff, they are looking to you, whether that's they're looking at you for guidance or whether they're judging you.
No, and effectively, it is guidance, isn't it? I mean, you are the captain of the ship.
Yeah, and, you know, that comes with a responsibility, but it's also a privilege. And I think that's sometimes that when you're in these positions, it can be... it can be stressful. It can be all-consuming at times, but it's a real privilege. There's millions of people out there that would want to be in the jobs and the positions that I've had or currently have. So when you're in those positions, you have to enjoy it as well. You have to embrace every moment, and, you know, give it your all, because, you know, and I know at some point it's gonna come to an end.
The official Brighton and Hove Albion podcast.
So from there, I mean, you were a Portsmouth under-18 manager, came to Brighton, went to England, then went to Southampton, jumped around the South Coast a lot, and then eventually you settled down as Brighton Academy Coaching and Pathway Manager. I've got that right.
That is spot on, Glenn. Top stuff, mate. Top stuff. It's not an easy title.
So how did you find going from men's football to the academy stuff, and where you're in more of a results-based business to more of, it doesn't necessarily matter about the result, it's more about developing the individuals?
Yeah, there's a real sort of seminal moment that sticks out to me. I remember going to, as you say, from Salisbury to Portsmouth youth team. And, you know, we had a great pre-season, started the league really, really well. And, you know, I think we won something like our first seven or eight games. And I remember the academy manager, Mark Kelly, who's a very close friend of mine and has been a mentor to me throughout my journey, sitting down with me and saying, "Oh, how do you think it's been going?" I said, "Well, it's been great, hasn't it? Like, we've won pretty much won every game. Like, it's been top." And I just remember him saying to me, yeah, it's been good, hasn't it?" He said, "Do you know what your job is?" And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Your job, what's your job?" And I said, "Well, it's just to, you know, to prepare the team and to develop the players, try and make the players better and, you know, and win some games." And he went, "Yeah." He said, "But you need to shift your mindset from preparing a team to win a game on a Saturday." He said, "It's not the job. The job is we need to get two or three players that are capable of playing in the first team in 2 years' time." So he said, "So you need to shift your thought process from week to week to the result is at the end of this 2 years." And I just remember it absolutely blew my mind because I just thought, oh, all I'd known was how to go game to game, try and win the next game, Saturday, Tuesday. And then I had to look at more, it's more about the individual development. It's more about getting the best out of the best players that could play in Portsmouth's first team.
So how did you change your approach?
Just had to be mindful of it, really, and work on it, get advice, speak to other coaches, other people that I trusted that had been in that environment, in the academies, in the development environment. But I think that conversation was almost enough. It was just a shift of sort of mindset, like I say, that I needed. And again, you know, we were really, really fortunate to coach some brilliant players during that time. One of them who's doing brilliant for Kieran McKenna at Ipswich is Connor Chaplin. So he was obviously one of the shining lights of the youth team at that time.
Webby wasn't in there, was he?
So Webby was a little bit older. So Webby was already in the first team when I was there. But you could always see Webby's quality. You know, we actually did. I can remember Webby being in the first team as a young player. And when Paul Cook came in and the year that Portsmouth won League Two, he was very possession based. Everything was with the ball. And I remember Webby coming to me, and this is just a sign of, you know, his desire to be the best that he could be, coming to me and saying, "Mikey, like, we always have the ball and we're always practicing possession and build up and things like that." He said, "But every time a ball comes out the lights at Fratton Park, I feel like my timing's all over the place, and you know, I'm not sort of winning my aerial duels." So he's like, can you put on some sessions for me with the youth team lads?" And that's him coming and asking me that to do that at 19, 20. You could see how driven he was, and you know, how aware of what he needed to do to be successful. So you know, you always knew that Webby was going to go on and play the level he's played, and you know, he's a top professional and a top lad.
Yeah, he is indeed. So talk to me about your role at Brighton and how you've enjoyed, and obviously you've been to a lot of amazing places, but this facility to bring players on must be incredible.
Yeah, absolutely. Obviously, this is my second time at the club. So I came here from Portsmouth first time round, and then had an amazing 2 years here in the 18s. And you could see then where the club was going. Even at that time, you could see that, you know, the vision, the direction of the club, the leadership was really, really clear. And I loved my 2 years at the club then. And actually, I speak about this a lot. I didn't actually want to leave.
I've been in that position before.
Yeah. You know how it feels. And I had the opportunity to work and to coach an England team, which, you know, as we've alluded to, I don't have an illustrious playing background. I don't have loads of experiences. I'm not a high profile name. So to get the opportunity to work with an England team was one that I couldn't turn down. And, you know, I remember getting Dan Ashworth's advice on it, because obviously he'd not so long come from England. And, you know, he said, you know, you'll regret it if you don't do it.
And it might never come again.
Exactly. And he said, but it was really interesting because he said, you'll struggle though with the gaps between camps, and there's not much coaching.
Not much time on the grass.
Exactly that. And I remember saying, I think I'll be all right with that. I definitely wasn't. So again,
how did you feel that time?
You just end up basically being like a talent ID scout. So you end up going to a lot of games, writing a lot of reports on your own, which for someone like me who likes being around people and being in an environment where you're kind of bouncing around a team was a challenge.
But I suppose it's another string to your bow, isn't it?
Yeah, and look, the experiences that I got during that time, because, you know, just after I joined there, COVID hit. So that meant that I was only there for a year due to the restructure of the FA. But during that time, I was able to interact with Steve Holland, Gareth Southgate, Lee Carsley, you know, all these vastly experienced people and coaches who are not only fantastic coaches, but like amazing human beings. You know, I think as a leader, Gareth is, he's top, like outstanding, the way he handles the players, handles the staff. You know, again, to be in the privileged position of sort of interacting with him and seeing how he works.
Is he the best at setting a culture that you've seen?
I think so. From what I've seen, you know,
because from the outside, we obviously, I think England have opened the doors, and we see more of the players. We see more of the players' personalities. Mm. But Gareth is literally the only manager in my generation that has been able to do that. Even though we've all often had a littering of the best individuals in the world, we haven't been able to gel them like he has.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I genuinely don't think he gets the plaudits that he deserves. Appreciate we've not won a tournament, which is what we all
want. Well, I've just enjoyed going deep into them, that's all. I don't need to win anything.
But, you know, I think we've got a real chance this summer. And like I say, you know, I would support him, Steve, the staff, because they work incredibly hard. And like you say, it's... You know, I'm not sure what's the hardest job, being England manager or being the Prime Minister of of our country. I'm not sure. There's probably a discussion to be had there. But I think he's got one of the most difficult jobs in football. And I think the way he handles himself and the way he deals with it all is an inspiration to me personally, and to, I'm sure, a lot of coaches throughout the game.
Is he still on the speed dial?
he's been really good over the years, genuinely, a couple of times in my career where I've had difficult moments. Yeah, he's been there, which I'm really grateful for.
And just bringing it to the here and now, you are interim head coach of Brighton Hove Albion women's team. Mm-hmm. How has that been? And was it something that you planned for, or did it just completely come out of the blue?
Completely out of the blue, yeah. Completely out of the blue.
A nice surprise.
An amazing surprise, you know, incredibly humbled, grateful to the club for sort of entrusting me with the role for this period. Yeah, definitely not something that was on my radar. As I said, when I first sort of, you know, spoke to the media, I probably looked a little bit shell-shocked. But again, an opportunity that doesn't come along very often. So you've got to grab it with both hands and give it everything you've got. And that's what I've done to this point. The players have been amazing. The staff have been amazing. And I think one of the nicest things is the support that I've had from the academy staff and the academy players. And just, I think one of the things that I've really seen over the last month is we speak about almost there's a little bit of an invisible barrier between sort of the women's side and the boys and men's side. And over the last sort of 4 to 5 weeks, I think we're really seeing that barrier start to break down and a lot more interaction between the two buildings, so to speak, both from a practical sense and from a, you know, are sharing ideas.
Surely support. You are a massive part of that, having transferred from the academy into the women's side of it. That's never happened up to this date, has it?
No, not to my knowledge.
Well, not here.
Yeah, not here. But I think it's probably easier for me because I am sort of in both camps. I think if you're a head coach coming in from the outside, you know, maybe it's not a priority, you know, and I don't understand that sort of building relationships with the academy and the men's side.
It's hard. You've already built those relationships, haven't you?
Exactly. Exactly. I've already got them, so it's easy for me to tap into them. And what I truly believe is that both buildings can learn from one another. So there's some stuff that I'm seeing on the women's side that I'm thinking, oh, that's really good. Some of those processes, we could bring them into the academy, and that would make us better. Likewise, there's things on the men's and boys' side that you go, okay, well, if we took some of that and bring it over to the women's side, then that could be advantageous for them as well. You know, the values of the club are, you know, we are one club. We work together, you know, and we want to epitomise those values throughout the whole club. And
yeah, because even though it might not seem it, and the girls do sometimes play up at Crawley, we are all in one training facility, aren't we?
Yes, exactly. And as I say, the biggest thing for me is, and I get sort of the mickey taken out of me quite a lot for this from the other staff and stuff, but I'm a big believer in feel and energy. And I think if you've got good energy around the building and everyone's sort of pulling in the same direction and there's a good feel, then you probably get that extra 5-10% out of everyone. You know, like the support and the level of interest in the women's side in the last 4 or 5 weeks has been amazing. And you know, the players are getting people going up to them saying like, oh, well done, brilliant on the weekend, 7 goals, amazing, you know, all that sort of stuff. And again, that just, I feel that there's something in that we don't, you know, fully understand.
How much is the onus on you to bring that energy as the head coach? Because I think I see it more and more these days. And I do refer to the men's game, but like your Jurgen Klopps, your Pep Guardiola, even Roberto here, managers with real personality and energy on the touchline, and they seem to be really successful. And you, like I said, you mentioned energy. So how much do you feel as it falls on you to go in every day full of vigour?
Yeah. I think that's part of the responsibility. I think it's also really important that you're yourself as well, and you're authentic. You do see it, particularly with young coaches who maybe try and be a certain way because they see the likes of Roberto or Jurgen or Pep acting in a certain manner, and they feel like that's what you should do in a head coach role. I think it's really, really important to be yourself and be authentic. I'm generally pretty naively optimistic, so
that's a good trait.
So I tend to be pretty positive. I tend to do things with a smile on my face, and that's real. That's me. So you have to bring that energy. That's part of your responsibility in a leadership role. I do also think that another aspect of it is making sure that you empower the staff that you're working with and the players to also be themselves and be authentic, and bring their best version of themselves to the table every day, because that's how you give yourself the best chance of success.
How we've spoke about the transition from men's to academy, and then you spent quite a number of years in that system, of the academy system, and developing players and bringing them through. You're back to results-based business. How has that transition been from the men's side, men and boys side of things, to the women's side?
Yeah, I felt like I've kind of sort of gone back 10 years back to sort of relying on some of the lessons that I learned from being the manager at Salisbury. I think also a much better coach than I was then. I've had a lot of experience. That's what, you know, being in the academy system, coming up against Premier League Category 1 academies, you know, week in, week out, that gives you the level of tactical knowledge that you develop, the technical, all the kind of experiences that you have can only help you when you come back into this situation. You know, I think the managers that I've seen work at first team level, albeit in the men's game during that period, you always look to learn from them and take the best bits from each one and see if you can put them into the mix for something that's authentic to you. You know, it would be foolish not to be influenced by the way Roberto plays, but it's important that we don't try and copy that, you know, plan for plan, because the men's game and the women's game are very different, and no one can deliver Roberto's style like Roberto. So you know, there'll be influence there. There'll be influence from Graham when he was here. There'll be influence from Chris when he was here. There'll be influence from the managers that I saw at Southampton, Ralph Hasenhüttl. You know, I've taken a huge amount from him in terms of the out of possession side of the game and the pressing. Going back to Portsmouth, Paul Cook, again, really, really possession based style of play. So you kind of take all of those sort of influences and then your own experiences.
What does that give us? What is your style, or do you look at a group and think, I've just got to tinker what I slightly do to suit this group, or are you more like, this is what I want to do?
Yeah, I think hopefully a balance of the two. So I feel like, and hopefully people that have been to the games will see that I believe that we've got a clear identity in terms of what we want the game to look like with the ball. We want to dominate the ball. That is the identity of this football club, whether that's men's, academy, women's team. We want to dominate the ball. Part of dominating the ball is when you don't have it, you need to get it back quickly. So, you know, we want to be aggressive. We want to press. We want to get the ball back as quickly as we possibly can. In both boxes, set piece wise, we want to be organised. We want to be structured. And we want to make sure that we improve at those, because that's an area that we do need to improve in. And then for me, it's just, you know, the day that I started this role, I said to the staff and players, for me, that the non-negotiables are we work really hard. You know, that's a non-negotiable. And we enjoy ourselves. And we try and win some football matches.
I think that sometimes gets overlooked, enjoyment.
Absolutely. And again, I just think if you're in a state of mind where you're positive about coming in every day, you're positive about training, you go into the games positive, you know, the meetings are engaging and you're not kind of coming in in a sort of a threat state or a state of fear or anything like that, then I think you can get a huge amount out of staff and players. So don't get me wrong, it's serious, of course, and there'll be moments where it's important that we get the job done and things are done seriously. I also think that you can have fun at the right times and you can enjoy yourselves and you can work really, really hard and have a good time and be successful.
I was really pleased you said that about the enjoyment, because I think a lot of coaches overlook it. They get bogged down with the results-based business. But I was always a firm believer in, if you're happy off the field, you're more than likely to be happy on it, and therefore what you give is so much more, and what you produce is quite often so much more.
I couldn't agree more, and I think that, you know, sometimes the seriousness or the lack of enjoyment comes from pressure, and I think
from the top.
Agreed. So I think when you're in this role, flipping that mindset of, I'm under pressure, you know, this is a really big role, it's really important, we've got to make sure that we stay in the WSL, we've got to make, you know, this is on me, it's actually flipping that to be, what an opportunity this is. You know, we've got an opportunity to finish in the top half of the WSL, we've got an opportunity to get to an FA Cup final at Wembley. You know, I've personally got an opportunity to bring a group of staff and players together and to help them to be the best versions of themselves, to help them enjoy coming to work every day. Like the difference between those two mindsets is huge.
Perspective.
Absolutely.
And at the minute, without doubt, it's working. I'm going to put the Villa game down as a 1-1 draw. We'll forget about the pens. You beat Wolves 4-1 in the FA Cup. Liverpool, yeah, a very narrow defeat, but obviously Liverpool, a powerhouse in both the men's and the women's game. Mm. And then a huge 7-3 victory against Bristol. And we've got the kind of small matter of an FA Cup quarter-final at home this weekend. Huge game for the club.
Massive. I think when you get to this stage of cup competitions, particularly the FA Cup, where you know the finals are at Wembley, it's really exciting. And, you know, nice to be at home. We're hoping for a sellout crowd, which will be an incredible atmosphere. And we played Man United a couple of weeks ago away from home. We lost 2-0 on that occasion, but there was very, very little in the game.
But the girls were just learning your philosophy then, weren't they?
Yeah, exactly. Let's hope.
Your first game.
Yeah, of course. So, you know, I think we'll be well prepared. We'll go into the game full of confidence, having scored, you know, 7 goals on Sunday. That's going to give the players a huge lift going into that game. And if we can get a fantastic crowd behind us, a really big atmosphere, and they can drive us on to a victory, then, you know, suddenly you're one game away from an FA Cup final and making some history. So we'll be giving it absolutely everything we can, and we'll go into the game full of positivity.
Now you're back in management, is there such thing as a work-life balance?
Oh, great question.
I'm taking that as a no.
It's really tough. It's really tough. You know, if you ask my partner, she would probably say no. There's not a work-life balance. You know, I have a little boy as well who's nearly 8, and you know the woman's schedule of games on a Sunday, training on a Saturday doesn't lend itself to you know, to loads of time with him, which is tough. But I think for me, you talk about work, you talk about life, you've got one life. There is no separation for me. I try to be present wherever I am. If I'm at work, I'm at work. I'm fully focused. I'm in the moment. You know, if I'm at home, I'm at home. I'm present. I'm in
That's
the moment.
Really hard to do that, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is. It's been a practice for me for probably 10 years. I get it's another thing that I get stick for in the academy. They call me Mindful Mike, which is always a bit of a laugh. The 21 staff, you know, I do try and practice that every day. You know, I think all you can do is, wherever you are, be present and be in that moment. So I try to do that at work. I try to do that when I'm at home. I try to do that with my little boy. I try to do that with my friends. But it's pretty busy, for sure.
And now that you're over on the women's side and you can see, well, in fairness, I think we can all see the development of the women's game, and obviously massive news recently, Arsenal selling out the Emirates, so that there's definitely a new fan base for the game. And the pathway now for young girls is clearly there, which hasn't been for so many years previous. Mm. With those clear pathways, how big can the women's game get, and what height can it reach?
I think the sky's the limit. From what I've seen, like you say, Arsenal selling out the Emirates, a lot of the crowds in the WSL are increasing year on year. I think the academy system is developing all the time. That's one thing that I've learnt since I've been over there. The way the academies are developing, it's almost, you look back to the kind of the EPPP introduction in academies. I'm not sure how long ago that was now, maybe 10, 12 years ago, something like that. There's similar processes being put in place on the women's side of the game. And I think, you know, you can already see the young players that are coming through now, particularly here. You know, they've been affecting our first team squad, and some of them are still 16, 17, and they're already ready to to train with the first team day in, day out, because they've been training for so much longer. So I think the standard of the players is only going to increase. So therefore, the standard of the game is only going to increase. So therefore, you know, the interest and the level of participation and then therefore spectators is only going to increase over the next few years. So I'm really excited to see where it goes. And, you know, it's nice to be a part of it at this moment in time.
And it's so nice for those little girls who are starting to play football, you 6-7-year-olds, to actually have pin-ups and people to follow and try and become like.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I look at the Bristol City game. You know, my friend who lives in Bristol, who I went to school with, haven't seen for a couple of years, has two daughters who are both into football. And, you know, they came to the game on Sunday, and, you know, they saw a 10-goal thriller, so a good one to come to. And, you know, he's already messaged me saying, you know, they can't wait to get out and play. And it's that sort of stuff that kind of makes you feel really privileged to be able to be in this position to, I guess, inspire the next generation of young girls to be, you know, WSL players, to play for their country. So it's exciting.
Well, Mikey, I'm not going to put you on the spot and ask if you want the job full time. But what I am going to do is I'm going to thank you for your time and your insight into all levels of the game. Thank you, mate.
Thanks, mate. Appreciate it.
That's all we've got for you this episode. Thanks for listening. Please rate, review and share the podcast if you can. And don't forget to check out our archive of shows with the great and the good of football.
The official Brighton and Hove Albion podcast. Sports Social Podcast Network.